Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Baroness Caroline Cox has flown the flag for so many important causes, it's hard to keep up. As a member of Britain's House of Lords, she's spent decades bringing justice to the world's most forgotten, suffering places. She's travelled to war zones to bring aid and support, giving a voice to those suffering in Poland, Sudan, Armenia, Uganda, Burma, North Korea, and many other nations. She's got degrees in nursing, sociology, economics. She's an outspoken advocate for people with disabilities, and that's just the beginning of her bio. Baroness Caroline Cox is in Australia right now to launch the Australian branch of her organisation, HART, that stands for the Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, and is with us now. I can call you Caroline, though, can't I?
Of course you can.
It's lovely to have you here.
It's my Christian name. Thank you, and it's good to be here.
Yes, it's certainly not your first time to Australia.
No, I'm fortunate to have been before, and it's lovely to be back.
How does one become a baroness? You've got to explain that, of course, for those ignorant members of the Australian public like myself.
Well, all I ever say about myself is I'm a nurse and a social scientist by intention. You've already mentioned that. A baroness by astonishment. And it was indeed God's sense of humour. I wasn't into politics. Must admit, I don't much like politics, but you become a baroness by being appointed to the British House of Lords, which is the equivalent of a Senate in other parliaments. And when you get appointed to the House of Lords, you become a baroness. But I was so much out of that word that I was the first baroness I ever met.
Oh, yeah.
So if you haven't met a baroness, join the club.
You see, Australians love that. You know, we kind of like the whole egalitarian thing. So we like somebody like you who's a baroness who's quite happy to be called Caroline. Now, you actually became a baroness because a book that you wrote actually caught the attention of Margaret Thatcher.
Correct. Now, way back in the 1970s, I'm quite elderly, I'm 73, so I've had a long life. But way back in the 1970s, I was in higher education, and at that time, Britain was having quite a lot of problems with infiltration with a really hard-line, far-left Marxist-Leninist and further-left Communist Party. And I headed an academic department of 20 staff, 16 of whom were Communist Party or further left. Their definition of higher education was not mine. Mine is freedom to pursue the truth within the canons of academic rigour, and you can study Marxism in that context, nothing wrong with that. But freedom to pursue the truth within the canons of academic rigour, theirs was hard line indoctrination, academic blackmail, character assassination, physical assaults. And everything I tried to stand for as a Christian, I tried to stand for truth and love. The opposite was going on around me, untruth, indoctrination, and indeed real hatred. And I fought that battle. I had to stand up for what I believed in for 9 tough years. And they were tough years, intellectually, physically attacked, academic blackmail, spiritually. And they were rough, tough years. But as I went through those years, I realised it wasn't only happening in my college, but in Britain, many of the academic departments in what you might like to say the softer subjects and the professional subjects like the social sciences, teacher training, social work, media studies, they were being targeted by many of these really hardline academic extremists. So it wasn't any happening in my department. Mm. And so I wrote a book about it because I was concerned. And it's rather well, a forceful title.
The Rape of Reason, I would suggest it is a forceful title.
The Rape of Reason, the Corruption of the Polytechnic of North London. And I didn't just write and run. I was going back to face the music. And I was quite nervous. But the day before the book was due to be published, I had a phone call from someone who was then a very well-respected columnist in the famous newspaper, the London Times. And the day before the book was due to be published, I was getting kids ready for school. Phone went with Bernard Levin. He said, "I've just read your book. I think it's the most important book for the future of democracy I've read for the last 10 years. I'm going to write about it in tomorrow's Times." Fantastic, a lifesaver. The strapline, brilliant. In all its brutality, the making of an intellectual concentration camp. And at the end, he said, "And because I think this is such an important book for the future of democracy, I'm going to devote my remaining 2 articles this week to discussing it." So he gave us 3 articles, a trilogy. He'd only ever done that before for Mozart and Solzhenitsyn, so we were in good company. But that, of course, got the book known, got me known, and I think I was put into the House of Lords as a kind of academic freedom fighter.
How did you develop then that kind of backbone? I mean, to be working in the sociology department with 16 members, paid-up members of the Communist Party, to face that kind of opposition for all those 9 years, to then write a book that then would take this on a public scale, where did you develop that?
Well, I think when you're in a situation like that, a little bit like as Martin Luther said, here stand I can do no other. I mean, I wasn't trained for this. I went in as the most politically naive person that ever walked into that polytechnic. I went in as a nurse who'd been working in nursing before I had TB, which knocked me out of nursing, which is why I went academic. But I was not prepared for this, but I just could not allow what was going on around me to happen unchallenged. I couldn't see the lies. But above all, it was awful seeing what happened to students. You get students who come in fresh-faced, open-minded, and if they became indoctrinated, they became members of the Communist Party, their whole faces changed. You had no longer have rational discussion, but the pressures on them were enormous. I remember one student coming to see me, and her husband actually was one of the academic staff who just joined the Communist Party, and the Communist Party told him that either his wife would have to join the Communist Party or he would have to divorce her. Mm. Rosie, a student of mine, a friend of mine, came desperate. What do? Do I join the Communist Party? Or he divorces me. Those are the kind of pressures going on. Well, you couldn't just let that happen. One had to stand up and speak out for the values which I believe in, the values of freedom, of liberal democracy, academic freedom, and freedom to pursue the truth.
Open House is what you're listening to. Baroness Caroline Cox is with us, the founder of HEART, the Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, which has just launched in Australia. Let me just ask you about how you came to faith, how you became a Christian.
I was born into a Christian family, an Anglican family. I was confirmed, as happens in the Anglican Church, about the age of 11. The bishop gave us a confirmation text, and I remember it to this day, Joshua 1:9, which is, "Have I not commanded you? Don't be afraid, don't be dismayed. I, the Lord your God, am with you wherever you go." And I must confess I'm often afraid and I'm often dismayed, but I do actually have to remember that. And I think God is very often very present, especially in the most difficult and challenging times.
That's almost a prophetic verse, really, for you as to what you would be doing for the rest of your life.
Well, indeed. And as I say, I'm often afraid and dismayed, but I do remember that verse.
Yes. All right. Let's talk about then all the work that you've done. I mean, you then have done so much work for the cause of those in what we might call persecuted countries, those who have suffered under various ideologies, or even those who people of faith are actually suffering for some sort of reason. Where did it begin? Was it Poland that it began?
It began in Poland, yeah. In the dark days of martial law, when the Solidarity Movement emerged with the famous Lech Walesa, and the Soviet Union cracked down on Poland big time, went under martial law, and the situation in Poland was horrendous. There was virtually no food in the shops, no medicines in the hospitals. People were dying. Children were dying, things they shouldn't die from. It could have been treated. Life expectancy for men dropped to 63, 65 in southern Poland. It was a place of real darkness and suffering. But I was asked then if I'd be a patron for an organisation set up as a kind of response in Britain called Medical Aid for Poland Fund. And I said I'd be honoured to be a patron, but only if, as appropriate, I could travel on the trucks to make sure the aid got through. And so I found myself living the life of a trucker for a week at a time. There were no hotels and motels to stay in. You live on the truck with your truck driver. And I can tell you the top bunk of a 32-ton truck is quite narrow. You can't even lie on your side. And sometimes it's a little bit challenging in the winter when it was very cold outside and we'd stop over in a lay-by for the night. And my Polish truck driver, with the windows up, would smoke toxic Polish cigarettes all night. But that was nothing compared to the suffering of the Polish people. And I always came back humbled and inspired by their courage, their dignity, their generosity, their radiant faith. I always received more than I could ever give.
Mm. What one memory from that those early forays into Poland will you never forget?
So many, but one, for example, in the University Hospital in Krakow, beautiful old city, in the children's hospital, in the cancer ward, there were babies, children there with leukemias and cancers that could have been treated on the other side of that terrible iron curtain. And I was with some of those kids who were having no treatment. They were obviously suffering. They weren't complaining. They weren't whining. And I went out to where the parents were in the waiting room, and I said, "I'd like to congratulate you on the courage of your children." And one of the mums said to me, "Yes, our children are very brave," and told me a true story of a 12-year-old boy in the middle of the Warsaw Uprising at the end of the Second World War, when Poland, Warsaw, did rise up, and it was absolutely crushed by the Nazis. They moved in with a horrendous force of tanks and pulverized Warsaw. And in the middle of that terrible situation with bombing and tanks and people dying all around him, a 12-year-old boy wrote these words on a wall: "I believe in the sun, even when I cannot see it. I believe in love, even when I cannot feel it." Amazing words, but written by a 12-year-old boy on a wall in Warsaw in the middle of the crushing of the Warsaw Uprising. That was the spirit of the people of Poland.
Yes, wow. Tell me about one of those truck drivers you were talking about getting quite angry at you when you brought some computer paper along with you.
Well, this reminded me of the price of freedom. We were nearing the end of our visit to Poland with one of these 32-ton trucks. I had a lovely Cockney truck driver called Tony, and we'd been great friends all week. He'd never got ratty or irritable until our last offload, and we were taking out our medical supplies, and the offloads were always surrounded by the KGB and customs people, and you had to run the gauntlet as you took the supplies off. And I'd been taking in things to the seminary because you worked through the local church. And as I climbed back onto this 32-ton truck, I found Tony swearing like a trooper. First time he'd lost his rag in a week, and I said, "What's the matter, Tony?" And I won't repeat his language on this programme, but he said, "Well, look at blankety-blank that," and I looked at what it was. They were just two boxes of blank computer printout paper. I said, "What's the trouble, Tony? Two boxes of paper?" He said, "Don't you blankety-blank realise we could be in prison for this?" I said, "I didn't, Tony, but if that's the case, shut up," because the walls of a 32-ton truck are not exactly soundproof, and there were KGB outside. So I said, "Well, look, give me a box of some other supplies and I'll take boxes underneath and hope I don't get intercepted." Well, I ran the gauntlet twice, got away with it. Tony went back to London that night. I stayed with a Polish doctor to learn more about what was happening. And I said to her, "I just don't understand. At that offload this morning, we had two boxes of blank paper." And Tony, my experienced trucker, said we could be in prison. She said, "Well, of course you could. Don't you realize in a totalitarian society, blank paper is dangerous. You could write ideas on it." What a price, freedom, blank paper is dangerous. And I was going back to an academic department that wanted to replace our free society with that kind of totalitarianism.
Yes.
The irony was acute.
Indeed, indeed. I was just connecting those two in my mind too, you know, just this whole issue of freedom there. Then Armenia, and even while you've been here in Australia, you've been meeting with Armenian communities and things like that. Tell me about your work there.
Well, that began in Moscow, and I was helping to organise a human rights conference with the widow of the famous Nobel laureate, Andrei Sakharov. And as I was chairing a group on human rights in Moscow, one member of the group with dark, burning eyes said, "While you lot here are talking about human rights, my people are suffering them." He was Armenian, and from a little Armenian enclave nobody's ever heard of called Nagorno-Karabakh, part of ancient Armenia that Stalin cut off from Armenia and put inside Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan was beginning ethnic cleansing of the Armenians from Karabakh. Began with so-called Operation Ring, the encirclement of Armenian villages with tanks, with helicopter gunships, with the BlackBerry forces, and Armenians would be rounded up, they'd be beaten up, they'd be brutalized, they'd be tortured, raped, have all their belongings taken, then driven off their land with nothing. And that was going on while we were talking about human rights in Moscow. So I was asked to lead a delegation down to investigate the situation with some other human rights experts. And what we found made us realize what was going on was very serious. It was Azeri, as Azerbaijan people, Azeri attempts to carry out ethnic cleansing of the Armenians from their historic land.
Caroline, for the budding, you know, peace warriors amongst us, I mean, what goes through your mind when you have somebody like that who comes to you and says, "Well, yeah, you're talking about it, it's happening for my community"? I mean, you then arrive in the area, you see what's happening. For most of us, we'd be crippled with, okay, what on earth do we do now? How does your mind work in those kinds of situations? What do you first off think about?
Well, what you think about is you've got to do something about it.
Yeah.
You've got to speak up, and you've got to try and help in whatever way you can.
But tactically, what is the first thing that you think about, the way that you can speak up and you can tactically help?
Well, first we've got to get the evidence. And you can be sure in a situation like this that Azerbaijan is very well funded with oil money. It'll be telling the world its version of events. So you've got to get there to get the truth in order to get the truth to offset their lying propaganda. For that, you've got to go there. So on that first visit down there, we actually wanted to see the evidence, but you also wanted to be seen to hear both points of view. You can't be accused of being partial or prejudiced. So crazy little group of us, one afternoon, we tried to cross into Azerbaijan officially, but they said no, because we were going from Armenia. So then we actually walked across the border carrying a white tablecloth on a pole as a kind of white flag. And the Armenians didn't want us to go. They said, "Well, they shoot across here every day, you'll get shot." We said, "Well, either you want us to get your story out, and for that we must hear the Azerbaijani point of view, means we've got to cross over and talk to them." So we crossed that line, and we did meet local Azeri commanders and the people, and we were able to come back and say we'd heard both sides, And what we saw happening definitely was a gross violation of the human rights of the Armenians of Karabakh. I've since been back 70 times, many of those fairly soon after that visit, when Azerbaijan then unleashed full-scale military war against the Armenians living in that little land. And it was hell on earth. Because its little enclave, Azerbaijan completely blockaded it, besieged it, bombarded it. I used to count 400 Grad missiles every day pounding down on the little capital city. Then Azerbaijan used low-flying aerial bombardment with huge 500-kilogram bombs just against innocent villages, against the little city of Stepanakert. It wasn't a battle zone, it was a town against the villages. Horrendous crimes being carried out against the Armenian people. So they had to go to get the evidence, to take in medical aid, because they had no anaesthetics, no painkillers. And so we began our lifeline. And so the answer to a question is you try and do something practically. And in heart, my organisation I'm here to establish, we believe in combining aid and advocacy for people who are suffering oppression. They need both.
Baroness Caroline Cox is with us, founder of Heart Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, which is just launching in Australia right now. This is Open House across the nation. So when you come back from countries like that, so many that you've actually had involvement in over the decades, do you then have the support of your fellow House of Lords? Do you go against them? Do you butt up heads? I mean, what kind of then support do you have, broadly speaking?
Well, clearly one has to speak up, has to be a voice for the voiceless, and usually get a mixed reception. There are certainly many peers, members of the House of Lords, who do support what I do and are very strong friends and allies. They're the ones who care about human rights, who care about injustice, who are prepared to say it how it is and not be compromised by political interests. But at other times, you could just tear your heart out. You come out brokenhearted with the appalling suffering you've seen, the appalling injustice, the appalling violations of human rights. I'll just give one example of the other side of the coin, the sad situation. I'd come out from Nagorno-Karabakh, this little Armenian enclave, and I'd seen Armenian children shredded by cluster bombs. Now, no one should use cluster bombs against civilians. Azerbaijan had been using cluster bombs quite deliberately and systematically. So I went to the British government, the minister of state then responsible for this part of the world, and said, please, will you make representations to Azerbaijan to stop dropping cluster bombs on children? The answer I got had full marks for brevity. All he said was, no country has an interest in other countries, only interests. And we have oil interests in Azerbaijan, and showed me the door. I can tell you, I went out and I cried my eyes out. It was my government who could do something about it. We were so compromised by oil interests, we're not going to do anything about it. So anyhow, we had a debate in the House of Lords. I quoted that. I said, for the first time in my life, I'm ashamed to be British. I'm not naive. I can understand strategic interests. I can understand commercial interests. But I don't think it's the long-term interest of any nation to let those obliterate concern for human rights. I don't think the majority of British people would want oil at the price of cluster bombs on children, at least without saying something about it. But that's often the double whammy. You come out full of grief at the suffering you've seen, and then get a double dose of grief when governments don't want to know.
We were mentioning before the amount of countries that you've worked in, as well as Poland and Armenia, also Sudan, Uganda, Burma, North Korea, etc. All of these very dangerous countries in many a case. I mean, when has been the moment where you have felt most at danger, personally, of losing your life?
Oh, many times. I was told I was nearly killed 22 times in Nagorno-Karabakh. Flying into Sudan, to no-go areas in Sudan, when Khartoum, in the war against the South, told me that they would like to shoot us out of the sky. We had brave pilots who would fly us into the forbidden airstrips. Very often I've gone, you know, knowing that it is immensely dangerous. And I do get afraid. I get what I call my fit of faithless, fearful dread. I shrink from going. And I remember one occasion I had my fit of faithless, fearful dread before going into Karabakh at the height of that war. Did I really want to get shot down in a helicopter under fire? And I didn't tell everyone about it because there's no point in spreading gloom and doom. Next morning I went to church and the Bible reading from the Gospel was, he who is not prepared to leave husband, wife, brothers, sisters for my sake isn't really to be my disciple. But then there was an extra bit I never noticed before. But he who does leave husband, wife, brothers, sisters for my sake will find new brothers and sisters even under persecution. And all I will say is that when you do actually cross your frontier of fear, when you do go beyond that frontier to where you're going, you meet the most wonderful people. And in all the countries where we're working, we meet real heroes and heroines who never fail to inspire us with their faith, their courage, their dignity, their generosity. The poorest people in this world are always the most generous, and we always come back humbled, inspired, receiving more than we can ever give. So that gives one, again, the motive to go beyond that frontier of fear, and we know that it will be a privilege to be with the people we meet on the other side of that frontier.
Yes. While we're on the topic, what do you understand the gospel of Jesus to mean? I mean, you know, in the past we've kind of had this polarization in the Christian church of, you know, just social works or, you know, just eternal security for your soul after death. What is the gospel of Jesus, the good news of Jesus to you? How do you encapsulate it in your own mind and heart?
Well, Jesus put it very simply, didn't he? A new commandment I give you, love one another. And love is not a soft sentimental thing. Love has to be put into action. And action is very clearly spelled out in the Bible. Speak for the oppressed, heal the sick, feed the hungry, clothe the naked. And not just the Christian hungry, the Christian naked, the Christian oppressed. I think we have a Christian mandate to be available for everyone unconditionally in terms of compassion, in terms of speaking for the oppressed and giving a helping hand. I also happen to be a third order Franciscan, trying to follow a little bit in the footsteps of St. Francis. Mm-hmm. And St. Francis had a very powerful challenge to us. He said, pity weeps and turns away. Compassion weeps and puts out a hand to help. Now, when we see those awful pictures on television, and they're the ones that do get onto our radar screens, we, on the whole, we're the people who don't get onto our radar screens, but we see equally, or even perhaps more, tragic and heartbreaking situations. It's very easy to see those scenes, weep and turn away, but much greater privilege to weep and then put out a hand to help. And one of the things that I love about Heart is we do work with many of these people trapped still behind closed borders. We do have the privilege of putting out a hand to help, and it is such a privilege to make a difference. And we've got so much, haven't we? We've got freedom, we've got relative plenty. We really can make a difference for some of those people who are suffering, and at Heart we particularly focus on those trapped behind closed borders who are not being served by major aid organisations, unreached, unhelped, unheard. You work through local partners, they're the real heroes and heroines, they make a difference to their own people, and it's such a privilege just to help them make that difference.
Wrapped up in those two words you were talking about before, it's both aid and advocacy. It's both the practical hand as well as the speaking out, both together, which I really, really like, which segues nicely then to you opening up Heart in Australia, which will kind of have a focus, I understand, on East Timor.
Well, we're already in Heart working in East Timor, Timor-Leste, with wonderful partners there in a program helping to address the problem of malnutrition. We're also working in Burma. We don't call it Myanmar because the local people hate the word Myanmar.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It was imposed by the military dictatorship that now rules so brutally. They like being called Burma. And the ethnic nationals particularly suffer at the hands of the present military junta. It has that lovely name, SPDC, stands for State Peace and Development Council, and George Orwell couldn't have done better. Mm-hmm. It's a brutal military regime that oppresses its own people. We always remember those courageous Buddhist monks who demonstrated because they were so concerned at the plight of the Burmese people. Brave, brave men and women who demonstrated then. They knew what could happen to them, and indeed many of them have paid a high price, which we don't know about, since that courageous protest was cracked down upon. Mm. Quite a lot have been killed and tortured. So brave men and women, they knew what could happen to them. But they were really protesting for all the people of Burma. But some of the people of Burma who are suffering particularly harshly are the ethnic nationals down the east side, the Shan, the Kareni peoples, and they're suffering military offensives. They're being attacked in an attempt to drive them off their land. In just 1 month alone last year, 30,000 Karen and 10,000 Shan people were driven off their lands with a shoot-to-kill policy. You either had to run or you got killed, and living displaced in horrendous conditions, hiding in the jungles, or joining the hundreds of thousands already who've had to flee into exile across the border in the overcrowded camps in Thailand. It's our great privilege to give a little bit of a helping hand to those people. I love to tell the stories of our heroes. We have one very heroic young man who's our partner who works across the border with the mobile medical teams. And when we saw him last time to give him the resources he needs, I shall never forget, he said, you know, when we're there in the rainy season, we're always cold. In the rainy season, we get soaked to the skin. Our sleeping bags are soaked right through. When we go to bed at night, we're freezing cold. But maybe, he said, courageously. That's a good thing, because you can't sleep too deeply if you're that cold. And maybe we shouldn't, because we had to be prepared to run at 3 minutes' notice if SPDC soldiers come. And I always have to hang my hammock low for four reasons: to be below bullets if they attack us, to be above shell blast in case they attack us with shells and shell blast can come upwards, slightly less cold nearer the ground, and if I fall out, it's less far to fall. But then with real fear in his eyes, he said, you know, I couldn't go in if I didn't pray. That's real courage. Mm. When you're afraid and you still go. And he, like many of the others working there with the displaced inside the jungles of Burma, know if they're caught, they'll have a fate worse than death. And one of his colleagues doing similar work just 4 days ago was shot by Burmese soldiers looking after a patient. Those are the kind of heroes and heroines we work with.
Yes. Where would you like to take heart next? What country is on your radar that you would like to go and be a part of?
Well, as you said, we hope that our partners here in Heart Australia will be taking primary responsibility for people in your geopolitical area, which would be obviously Timor-Leste, East Timor and Burma. We work together there at the moment, and also with the Chin Hill peoples in Western Burma. We hope to be starting a new program in India for so-called temple prostitutes. Those are situations where poor families give their young people to the temples for a life of service, who then get abused. And we hope to be working with another partner there, rescuing some of those and providing rehabilitation and a future for them. And then in Africa, we're working in northern Uganda. So we have a centre there for orphaned and abandoned children who are HIV positive. And then in Sudan, only 13% of people have immunizations. You still get polio, diphtheria, whooping cough, measles, things you shouldn't get, tetanus. So we're helping with primary healthcare clinics, rebuilding schools and programs for widows, because widows have a particular difficult time in those harsh post-war conditions. And in northern Nigeria, we're working there because there's been a lot of violence there recently, a lot of killings, and we're hoping with a Christian Institute, training for maternal and child health, and schools, and particularly schools in some of the Sharia states where Christians have a particularly tough time with the discrimination against them.
Mm. You must go to bed each night with a whole heap of things buzzing around in that mind of yours because of the amount of projects that Heart is running and the amount of things that I'm sure that would be breaking your heart at any one moment in time. The Christian faith certainly is, it's the heart of what you do, isn't it? I mean, would you go as far as saying, I'm probably, you know, leading you here, but would you go as far as saying that you wouldn't be doing this unless you actually had that Christian faith?
I'd be much less likely to be doing it, certainly. But it doesn't always help my Christian faith. Sometimes it challenges it deeply. You know, when you see that raw, raw suffering, you get thrown into your soul, your spirit, your mind, all these fundamental questions. How can a God of love, who's omnipotent, who's omniscient, the God of love as Christians we believe in, how can he allow these things to happen to innocent people, and particularly to children? Now, I remember once I'd been in the killing fields of Sudan, and I'd been walking through human bodies more than I care even to remember, and seen the suffering and the scorched earth policy. And as I got back to the airstrip where we were going to fly out from, I just sat on my sleeping bag outside my tent and howled, cried my eyes out, and my faith was really challenged. And I thought, how can a God of love allow the horrors I've just seen? And then I was thinking, and I thought, well, maybe one of the reasons why we as Christians, maybe we who live in the comfort zones of the West, find it rather difficult to deal with this challenge of suffering, particularly man-made suffering, is reflected, funnily enough, in the way we keep Christmas. Of course, as Christians, it's wonderful to keep Christmas. Christmas is all about God of love coming down and becoming one of us, coming alongside us and showing us his nature of love and sharing our life with us. Of course, it's right to celebrate Mary's birth of Jesus. Wonderful. But while we're doing that and enjoying all our Christmas meals and presents and all the Christmas decorations and everything, we tend to forget that while Mary was celebrating the birth of Jesus, all the other mothers were weeping because Herod had killed their baby boys.
Indeed.
So why should we expect our generation to be any different? Why should we expect we don't have Herods killing the baby boys? That tragedy was right there at the time when we celebrate Christmas. But while we celebrate it in the comfort zones and forget that raw reality, it's not surprising we don't have a theology that can deal with that kind of tragedy that still hits us between the eyes today. And then my mind went on thinking the end of Jesus' life. when he died in agony upon the cross, and Mary, his mother, could only stand there at the foot of the cross and be with him in ultimate grief and anguish. It occurred to me maybe one of the call to Christians should be we ought to be prepared to attend whatever Calvaries our Lord may call us to attend, to be there, as Mary was, in grief and anguish and suffering and feeling as helpless as she did, but at least to be there in love and in grief and in deep respect. And I think that's really perhaps the Christian's calling. You don't have to be in the killing fields of Sudan. You can be in a local hospice down the road or with a local homeless who'd just been turned out onto a pavement. Mm. But to be prepared to be alongside those who are suffering, that's where our Lord was. And that is, I think, is a Christian's mandate. And there's no solution to the mystery of suffering, but at least if you're there at the foot of the cross, whatever kind of cross that was, that is God's indication of his nature of love, and there maybe we find the answer to the mystery of suffering. Yes. In God's love incarnate on the cross. Mm. Of course, as Christians, we know and believe that Jesus rose from the dead, but at the time of the cross on Calvary, that wasn't known, and that perhaps is where the heart of the answer to the mystery of suffering lies.
Mm. Indeed. Well, Baroness Caroline Cox, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much for your time and for dropping by Open House tonight.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a privilege to be with you and share a little bit of the pain and the passion of what we do and what we're trying to do in Heart. And if anyone's interested, we hope you'll join us in Heart Australasia.
Well, the website heart-uk.org is the place if you'd like to find out more. And that's for a Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.